it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. You're listening very much in the future because I'm recording this before the Champion of Champions final between Ronnie O'Sullivan and Judd Trump. So by the time you listen to this, you'll know who's won. I've no idea, and I wouldn't like to make a prediction. Not least because it would be foolish. Because by the time you hear this, you will know. But it promises to be a great day. Let's hope it is indeed a great final. And then we're straight into the UK Championship. We have a qualifying already started at Ponds Forge in Sheffield, and then on to York on Saturday. The big news is, you may have seen this online, the big news is there's going to be commentary on the last 4 days of the qualifiers. So for the first 2 days, myself, Phil Yates and Stephen Haworth, getting the band back together after the Championship League experiences, we're going to be commentating on World Snooker Tour's Facebook and YouTube pages, and indeed on Discovery Plus. It's going out on there as well. So you'll be able to join us. And it's not just going to be, we're not just doing the sort of the normal match commentary that you'd see on television. We very much want it to be interactive. So we want snooker fans to contact us with queries and comments and any sort of questions you may have. Get in touch, and we want to interact, and particularly viewers watching all around the world, we want to know where you're watching, what you think of the action. We're going to be setting little questions and also competition, so you'll be able to win tickets to the UK Championship, tickets to various other things, sign programs, all that sort of thing. We're going to be on all three sessions on Monday and Tuesday, and then on Wednesday it's the two Judgment Day programs, and I'm delighted to say I've been asked to join Rob Walker and Ken Doherty for that as well. So that's the final round of qualifying over 2 days. The draw will be on Thursday, I think, between sessions is the plan at the moment. And again, we rely on people getting in touch and letting us know what they think, particularly about, of course, the history of the tournament. I'm not going to do a long history here. I've done it before, and you can go back and listen to previous episodes. But the UK Championship is a fantastic tournament, and I do believe this year it has sort of been restored to former glories, in as much as there's now a focus on quantity over quality. Sorry, I'll rephrase that. There's now, I've got it the wrong way around. There's now a focus on quality over quantity. In previous years, as you know, all 128 players at the venue, the second arena, which no one ever liked, it's been called a car park, it's been called a toilet. Nothing good has been said about that very cramped second arena. That's gone. It's now just two tables. It's the top 16, as at the World Championship, seeded into the last 32. And then 16 qualifiers facing them. And it means every match in the final stages will be televised. And there's kind of no hiding place. You can't come through from sort of table 3 or 4, keeping your head down. Everyone is out in the middle now. I think that's better, personally. Prize money's gone up. They're making an effort with the Barbican in York, the sort of the fan zone, the catering, all that stuff that's been talked about. Judd Trump, again, was talking about it this week. We'll maybe deal with that in a later edition of the podcast, because I think he made some interesting points. I also think that he could have been challenged on a few of them. But anyway, the World Snooker Tour are making an effort to sort of upgrade the UK Championship, because there's a feeling it's fallen behind. I mean, the World Championship is what it is, but certainly the Masters and a few other tournaments as well, the Tour Championship, the Champion of Champions indeed. Some people feel the sort of experience of attending those events maybe is better. So the UK Championship has been sort of given a bit of an upgrade. And as I say, quality over quantity, that's the way forward. So do join us online, as I say, the World Snooker YouTube and Facebook pages and Discovery Plus. And kudos, I have to say, to World Snooker, because myself and Phil, I don't think this is breaking any confidences, we did at the start of the season, go to them and say, look, you're not making enough of the qualifiers. If you're going to spread them out in the way they are over several days, but not put commentary on them, you're missing an opportunity actually to promote, your other tournaments, do ticket deals and that sort of thing. And they listened and they've come back and they said, OK, we're going to give it a go this week. So whether it's going to continue depends a lot to a great extent on how much people sort of get involved this week. Now, this episode of the podcast, thanks for all your emails. We're going to deal with them next week because this is a special episode. I say special. You'll be the judge of that. But we're doing a snooker player bingo with a twist. It's actually non-snooker player bingo. And self-explanatory, but it's basically people who've been around the snooker world, but are not players. Simple as that. So people, names you may know, names you may not know, but people who've been involved in the sport, but are not players. Neil Folds, Alan McManus and Phil Yates join me for that. But I'm just going to just do one email first because it is kind of pertinent to right now. It's from John Bennett. He said, I'm not sure if my point has already been discussed, but here goes. I applaud World Snooker Tour's decision to pay up to $20,000 to the low-earning players, but I hope this does not apply to players that aren't entering all available tournaments, Stephen Hendry being the obvious example. Has specific criteria been set out, or is this situation not clearly covered? I haven't seen anything covering such a situation. Clearly, it would be unfair for Hendry to play in two or three events and potentially get £20,000 and not win a match, where others play in all events with the expense that goes with it. What's your view or knowledge on how this will work? That's John Bennett. Well, John, you can put your mind at rest. No, that one of the contingencies of that is that the players have to enter all available tournaments. So if you enter one or two, you won't get it. And, of course, this has had a really positive effect, I think, because it's meant that we've seen players from parts of the world where it's actually financially maybe not viable to keep coming over everything, actually come over. We've seen, for example, Deshawat Poomjang has turned up, much to everyone's delight, from Thailand and various other places. Himanshu Jain from India, and we've got the Egyptian player Mohamed Ibrahim, and you know, obviously Andras Petra from Estonia. A lot of the international players are actually playing, and you've got to think that 20,000 guarantee is a massive reason for that. It's just taking a bit of the financial pressure off them. So yeah, you have to enter all available tournaments. But I do want to comment on the Stephen Hendry situation, because I think he's been very unfairly criticised, actually, this week by people who don't really understand the issues. The issue is this, OK? He is working for ITV at the Champion of Champions, and that is something that he, you know, many months ago would have been booked for. He wasn't to know that the UK Championship was going to be played at the same time, the qualifiers. Now, this whole situation could have been very easily avoided by doing just one very simple thing, and that is scheduling his second match on Monday. If that had been done, there wouldn't have been a problem. But in fact, his first match was scheduled for Saturday morning. That wasn't a problem. He could have played that. His second match, had he won, was scheduled for Sunday afternoon, when he would have been working on the final. So he would have, in fact, obviously would not have come back from Sheffield, so would have missed the last 2 days of the Champion of Champions. Had it been scheduled for Monday, he could have played Saturday. If he won, he could have then worked Sunday and then gone and played on Monday. Now, you might say, well, why should they organise a schedule around him? I would say, why shouldn't they? This is the thing. Last week, he withdrew on Sunday night when he realised what the playing schedule was. He got a reply from World Snooker on Monday morning acknowledging the withdrawal. An hour later, and this wasn't their fault because nobody told them, but an hour later, World Snooker's social media team put out these posts with his picture on, advertising the qualifiers off the back of the fact he's playing in them. And that's the whole point. That's the reason the likes of him and Jimmy and Ken Doherty have been given these wild cards. It's to try and generate interest. If you're going to try and generate interest, you have to understand that these legends are very much in demand to promote the game in other ways, particularly on television. So therefore, some heed has to be paid to that. They've got a problem in January. The Turkish Masters and Welsh Open qualifiers are being played during the Masters. So those three, who are all working on the Masters, have got to try and work out how they can possibly play in them. I think the first event, possibly there is a day before the Masters where they could play. But again, World Snooker have to be alive to that, and they have to look at the schedule, and they have to do their best to accommodate them. And Hendry did the right thing. He could have played the first match, and had he won, he could have pulled out the second one. But to be fair to Andrew Paget, who, had he beaten him, you know, might have been upset that his opponent then withdrew, he just said, no, I'm not going to play at all. And I thought he did the right thing, actually. And I thought the criticism of him was a bit lazy and a bit kind of predictable. Because he never said, I mean, I interviewed him when he announced his comeback. He never said he was going to play in everything. He never said, and you don't have to. Nobody has to. He can choose which events he plays in. He chose to play in the UK Championship, but the schedule didn't work out. So I thought the criticism of him was faintly ridiculous, actually. And I thought he did the right thing. And I think it could have been very easily avoided had World Snooker just scheduled his match for the Monday. The whole thing could have been avoided. Anyway, on that political hot potato, as I say, do join us for the qualifiers this week. Promises to be very interesting. Long days, I think. 3 best of 11s. We start at 9:30 British time every morning. So do join us for that. But in the meantime, it's non-snooker player bingo. As I say, it's about players. I'll rephrase that. It's not about players. It's about other people in the snooker world who have made a contribution over the years. And you're going to hear from Neil Folds, Alan McManus and Phil Yates as we join non-snooker player bingo. Okay, Phil, you're first up.
Okay, I think I'm going to go for someone who was a player of reasonable standard, but much better known as a referee. You know, in these days, this season, we've seen quite a few referee mistakes. But the person I'm going to talk about, I can't ever remember him making a mistake. And that's how good he was. A fellow Scott Allen, Laurie Annandale. He won the Scottish doubles, didn't he, with Stephen Hendry when he was an amateur. But predominantly, he's well known for his officiating. And I think he was one of the best ever, personally.
I thought he was very good, actually. I go back a long, long way with Laurie. The first tournament I ever played in was the Scottish Under-19s. And Laurie was the match secretary or whatever of the Scottish Billiards and Snooker Association. So that was the first time I came across him. It was up in Kirkcaldy in the Ambassador Club, remember that? I don't know if he was a good player. Did he play much?
Oh, decent. Yeah.
But a really good referee. I totally agree. Spent a lot of years on the tour. I'm guessing, good 15 years or so. Really nice guy. And actually, forgetting the professional game and the refereeing and all the rest of it, he was a really good administrator because when you showed up at the junior events in Scotland, this would be around 1987, I think, when I started playing in them. And everything was set in stone. The venue was good. He organised pretty much all that sort of stuff. Prize money, everything ran like clockwork. He was that sort of guy, Laurie, wasn't he?
Yeah. He didn't suffer fools gladly because he did everything himself efficiently, so he expected the same from other people. The other thing with Laurie was he made you laugh because he was such an old curmudgeon and such a moaner. I always used to be, full of chuckles in his presence.
Yeah, I mean, as a referee, he was someone that did the job quietly and efficiently. I think that's really what you're looking for, isn't it? Someone that does the job properly, it isn't the centre of attention. I'm not saying anyone else either. I'm not getting involved in that argument. I'm just saying that, you know, you almost don't notice the best referees. And I also know, I mean, obviously, I didn't know him personally that well, but, you know, he was the go-to man, wasn't he, for putting tips on and that. You know, he was the person at the time when a lot of the players would rely on Laurie to put a great tip on. As a referee, yeah, I think he was, he did the job very well, and as I say, with great efficiency.
I actually went to his house. He lived in Rosyth, just near the Fourth Rail Bridge. And I went there, and it was him who taught me to put a tip on a cue, sort of semi-properly. The way he did it was brilliant, and he told us a couple of stories. I remember he was a cue hound, as we call him. He loved snooker cues, old ones, and he went to some old guy's house years and years and years ago. And the guy had a bunch of, like, we know, Burwatt Champions, the old cues that are worth a few quid and all that. And the guy apparently was holding up his pea pods in the back garden with, like, Burwatt Champions and all sorts of, you know. That was kind of funny one, but a really good guy. And I kind of miss him because I've not seen an awful lot of him, but a top guy, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had to get between Andy Hicks and Quinton Hand at the Crucible. There's all sorts of things said in that match. And, of course, they got in one of those fights at the end. And Laurie very sort of calmly got between them and just sort of ushered them off the stage. The other thing I remember with Laurie, you'll remember this, Phil, he used to work in the press room, the sort of assistant. Now, traditionally, that's sort of a young person who's all full of enthusiasm. Fair to say, Laurie wasn't full of that much enthusiasm. And this was sort of years ago, so it was before even the match sheets got emailed to people. So the person who was doing that job had to print them out and hand them round. And he would come round, he'd walk round the press room. There's a lot of journalists at the Crucible who walk round going, slave to the press, slave to the press. completely disinterested in the whole thing.
There was one other just brief thing. One of the first tournaments I played in was in the Davis Club in Edinburgh, and it was on a street called Annandale Street. Uh-huh. And I stupidly, as you're a kid, I thought the street was named after Laurie. Obviously it wasn't.
I think Laurie kind of can stand for, you know, for all the refs, really. You know, I mean, we've been lucky in snooker to have so many top officials. It's not a glamorous life, is it? Let's be honest. You know, it's a lot of concentration. You kind of only noticed if you do something wrong. We've been at the Champion of Champions this week. We've got some great referees here. Young referee Marcel Eckhart has got really good, hasn't he? He's got really good.
Excellent.
In a short space of time. And a lot of the others as well. And of course, a lot of them are at the qualifiers for the UK. They're long days. They're best of 11. Some of them are doing two best of 11s. You know, not always the high standard. So we, as Rob Walker says, we can't do it without them.
I think Stephen flew him to tournaments.
He flew him to Antwerp to a tournament out there. The tip was defective. And because, of course, he had to pay for the ticket on the day, it cost £400, which back then was an awful lot of money. Laurie,
not to Stephen.
Well, it turned out to be profitable because Stephen won the tournament. But Laurie flew out to Belgium, put the tip on it, flew back the same day.
Okay, well, Neil, let's see your
opinion. Okay, I tell you, while we're on referees, I'm going to say Len Ganley, okay, because I thought I'd mention Len, and I thought maybe getting away from referees, maybe perhaps later on. Look, someone I still miss actually in the game. You know, he passed away a few years ago, and he was a different kind of referee to Laurie. He was, you know, outgoing. He was the centre of attention, but I never felt threatened by that. I thought he was a really good referee. He's a very difficult guy. A very difficult guy not to like, although being away with him for 3 or 4 weeks on the tour, he would start to drive you mad after a while, but in a good way, you know. And I thought he called me for a push shot at the Crucible once, which he wasn't one, but I just couldn't get annoyed with him. He just gave it on. I know that he would have given everything in good faith, and I think he was a strong referee, actually. I do think that, because he actually was the only referee I ever saw. It was in a match I was in, where he gave a miss when one of the players needed a snooker, because it was such a diabolical effort to hit the snooker. It was in my favour, so probably that's why I mentioned it. But it was. I played somebody at the UK, I won't mention his name, but there was a red by the black, and he was right about hitting the black. It was like 38 in or something. So he played it. Well, I mean, it's almost like one of these shots in pool where you, what do you call it in pool, where you just hit away, you don't even try.
Yeah, you push out.
Push out. It was like almost one of those. So he called a miss. And this player's horrified, but it was the right decision. So he was a strong referee, a good guy, although I did get in a car with him once, and he had an old car, and he was driving about 100 miles an hour on the motorway on a car that was not capable of doing that speed, and the whole car was shaking. You know, he was a real character.
He was an extraordinary character. He was larger than life. Yeah. He used to do this thing at the World Championship. He would collect a tenner for everyone to buy motorised wheelchairs for handicapped children. But he would never, if you'd never been there before, you didn't know what it was for. So he'd come up to people. He went up to Prince Nazim and said, give us a tenner, without saying what it was about.
It did eventually get to 20 quid.
Well, okay. But yeah, he was that, but yeah, he was all, you always knew he was in the venue, didn't you?
Yeah, I was lucky when I turned pro. Obviously, he was just a big star throughout the 80s. I mean, a huge star, really. And, he'd one of those voices, you know, as a player, as a kid growing up, it's the voice, isn't it? The John Streets, all these guys. And, eventually he's refereeing your match. And he also had, remember, we actually, it was a year ago, we went to the Nordbrek, and we stood in the holding area where we found an old snooker cue. That's another story.
But grizzly business, that
was. Yeah, very grizzly. He used to, when you get called in a minute before 10 o'clock, there was a countdown, and it was the holding area, and Len used to shout the immortal words, "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen."
That's very good, actually.
"Thank you, ladies and gentlemen." And then you went, right, it's match time, and in we go. And there's so much to remember.
He refereed the O'Sullivan maximum, and Ronnie says, you know, he was actually part of the reason he was so quick, because he just did the job.
Well, we did a little thing on that the World Championship last year. Anyway, I think referenced it at the time, he was almost dancing with Ronnie. You do that, I'll do this, and it worked beautifully. It was a fantastic.
He was in the advert, wasn't he? That he was part of that advert.
Yeah, Ball Crusher calling Black Label, I think it was. Yeah, well, you know, the Clive had the lowdown on how the trick worked. The spoiler alert, but apparently it was crushed cow shin in a condom.
Okay.
Sorry to break any illusions.
Cows? Shin, did you say?
Cow shin.
Shin.
S-H-I-N. Yes.
Yeah. Well, look, I started this podcast by saying one of the things with Laurie Annandale was I can't ever remember him making a mistake. I can remember Len making lots of them, but that doesn't make to say he wasn't a good referee.
He was a good referee, I think. Yeah.
Firm, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The two Len Ganley stories I'll tell were nothing to do really with the way he officiated a match. You could tell a million Len Ganley stories, but these are the two best ones, I think. One, he was on a plane going to China, I think it was to Hong Kong actually, and Len actually thought that he was a lot more famous than he actually was. And you know when you take off from Heathrow and then they bring the meal round after about an hour and then everything goes dark and you're expected to go to sleep. So they brought the meal round, they were clearing the meal trays away, and Len stood up in this plane and looked down towards, he was on the front row, looked down towards everybody and go, "If anybody wants my autograph, can you come down now? Because I want to go to sleep." And there's 100 people looking, "Who's this?" It was just ridiculous. So that's one. But the other one, when we went to Thailand, he was always a great one for going knick-knacks and stuff. And there was that phase going on, wasn't there? Those lasers, you know, those red lasers.
That's right.
And anyway, we came back from Thailand, and one of the next tournaments was Preston Guildhall. And he was refereeing there, and someone was making a noise in the crowd, and he said, can you please stop? Can you please stop? Third time, he put one of the lasers on this bloke's face. the red light was on this bloke's face. I think he thought he'd got some kind of hitman after him or something, yeah.
The movie Predator or something.
I must tell you one final one. Aberdeen. So this kid came up and asked him for his autograph. So his dad's gone, oh, well, we've got nowhere for Len to sign the programme. So Len said, don't worry. And he basically, he signed the back of the kid's coat. It was a Nike starter jacket.
I think what happened was he said, where shall I sign it? On the back. And he meant on the back of the program. Yeah, yeah. He just turned the kid around and there's Len Gandy written across his back.
Well, it was worth it, yeah.
On a Nike starter jacket, which was worth £100. And the reason I know it was worth £100, because Anne Yates, working in the WBBC office, felt so badly, she gave £100 out of petty cash to get a new coat.
And just a final thing on the, from a players thing and refereeing. To this day, when they call players in a multi-table setup, it's the same words, isn't it? It's thank you, gentlemen, or thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. And then the players go, he was brilliant.
You've got to do the Graham Horn story for him.
Well, yeah, he's playing, Graham Horn's playing, and Graham had got a block of chocolate.
Oh, I know this one.
On his table. And anyway, it was the, on the brown, in the deciding frame, and he's tapped Graham on the shoulder and said, Graham, can I have a block of your chocolates? I've got a bit low. Has he been on the brown in the deciding frame?
Yeah. I think that the point is, he's a name, I mean, he passed away, well, it must be at least a decade ago, and retired long before then, but he's a name you still hear mentioned a lot actually at tournaments. He sort of left his mark on the sport. Alan, you're up next.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a guy who did play, but he's more known as a commentator back in the day, and partly because I'm sure Phil and you guys will get to mention some of the stories about him. There's one in particular I'm interested in, is Mark Wildman. He had a club somewhere in the northeast-ish.
Sort of Northants way, wasn't it?
With Carrom tables.
Yeah, at one point he owned the only Carrom table. In Britain. I know that because Roxton Chapman was the British champion and he said he couldn't defend the title because Mark had moved to Spain and took the table.
He was in a place called Raunds, Raunds, yeah. But Mark Wildman was, we talk about chairman of the WPBSA, what a nice guy, what an absolute gentleman he was. And a lot of people don't realise with Mark Wildman, he actually got high enough in the rankings to play in the Masters on one occasion.
I know, he was a good player. He was very funny with my dad in the early days, and I didn't know Mark all that well until my dad played him in, I don't know, it was a two-session match, might have been the UK Championship. Went down to the last frame, and he was looking over at me all the time, Mark, you know, and obviously, clearly I want my dad to win. He's going, you'll get to our age one day, me and your dad, we can't pot a ball, you know, he's ridiculous and all this, and he would just laugh his way through it. He was a very good player though, quite a nervous man at times, but he was good fun, and you know, him and dad end up sort of, I remember the qualifiers were taking place in Blackpool, and they were both still playing, and my dad and Mark would sort of share an apartment and put the world to rights, you know what I mean, at that point. He was a great character, yeah, and as a commentator, was he ITV?
Mainly, yeah, I think he sort of did Eurosport, Sky as well.
Yeah,
ITV.
He did Irish Masters.
Yeah, for RTE, yeah.
He wouldn't have said a bad word about anybody. I can't think that it was in his nature to ever be too critical of anyone.
No, he was an eccentric, certainly.
Yeah, very much so.
And he used to have this skill. Every Sunday morning he'd say, go on then, pick a football match out at random, I'll tell you what the attendance was. And so you'd go like third division, whatever, it'd be, you know, Leighton Orient against whoever. And he would beat within about 1,000, wouldn't he?
The other thing, of course, he used to get people to bet with him that he would, you know, get the right attendance. So he'd say, yeah, I think, well, yesterday at Peterborough, I would say between 3 and 14,000. And they'd look in the newspaper and say, well, it was actually 2,760. No, I said between 3. he had me a few times on that.
Well, he had another one with a phone book. Did any of you guys ever? It was at the Irish Masters at Goffs, and obviously phone books are a thing of the past. But he would, I think, wherever he went, he checked the phone book, and he would say, he would say to you, Phil, give me a three-digit number, so 419, times that by 17 or something, so you're out with the calculator to do that. And whatever it came to was the page in the phone book, and he said, go down, you pick a number between whatever, and he would go down and say, yeah, it's Mr. Smith at Let's Be Avenue, whatever, you know. And you're all like, how the heck did you know? You know,
long, I don't know. Long days on the snooker
scene. Yeah, exactly. that was one of his things, but he was a good guy.
When he ran the billiards, it was some anniversary of Mozart's birth, and Mozart played billiards in his youth. And Mark had the idea that they would have this special tournament, but they would dress in the old style dress from Mozart's time, and of course it was completely impractical. They're wearing these sort of heavy suits, and just couldn't play. But that sort of guy was. He was very interesting to talk to. I remember Phil. We did a tournament where we had to go through a couple of sort of passport checks. I think Martin through Hong Kong, and he must have lost his passport 4 times.
Oh, it was ridiculous.
We'd go in, like, there were two sort of gates you had to go through, and
he just kept losing it. Shenzhen.
Yeah.
We went to that massive golf resort, and then we had to come through Shenzhen back into Hong Kong to get the plane back, and it was just a nightmare. He lost his passport more than any living human being, I think. Yeah.
But a really interesting guy, and he's in Spain now, long retired. Hope he's doing well. So we're back with you, Phil.
Okay, I'm going to go for someone who has recently retired and who was a true backstage warrior, Pete Godwin, the table fitter, who, you know, when you go to a pub sometimes and you see a barman or a barmaid, then you say, oh, they pull a good pint. Well, let me tell you, Pete put up a good table, didn't he? Mm-hmm. For years on end, he was an absolute master at his trade. And when he retired, it was a sad for all of us.
I always loved talking to him about the tables. Obviously, from 82 to about 95, it was BCEs. And the BC table, which, you know, the throughout the 80s, the Higgins, Alex Higgins was the first one in 82. He used to say that the BC tables were really difficult to work with, but when they were up, they were brilliant, especially when he put them up, the tables were awesome. He was absolutely amazing at his job. And there's a skill with table fitters, isn't there, with, I don't know so much now because technology gets better, but obviously there's 8 legs, 8 feet, or whatever you want to call them, and you would put beer mats under that one, but that would knock out the top two and then level it, because there's 5 slates. He was brilliant at levelling tables. I don't know how he did it.
Well, I don't know any of the, you know, on a more general, before we speak about Pete anymore, how these table fitters, I don't think they get anywhere near the credit they deserve. That is one tough job. And, I mean, from my own point of view, if I ever had to put one table together, it'd be one too many, because lifting the slates, dragging the cloth across and everything, that is an incredibly difficult job. They don't get the credit they deserve. But Pete was there from day one for me. Yep. Before, I think, when my dad was professional before me, you know, he was always there. And what he didn't know about that job is not worth knowing. You know, I mean, even recently, I spoke to him a lot at the Crucible, and when there was difficulties with tables, he was called back. Because I remember getting to the Crucible on the first morning when I was still with the BBC, and I said, hey, Pete, looking forward to it, because I've been here 10 days already. What do you mean? Like, he'd been up there ages getting the tables ready and all that. You know, it's not, they don't just turn up on the day. And then I think he left and left other people in charge, and he would reappear at the end. So I think later on in his role, he was overseeing it, but he still put tables up, don't get me wrong, but not as much. But it's reassuring to know people that really know the job, like him, were doing it.
You know, being a table fitter, just being like a top-class snooker player, you need precision, but you also need power to lift those slates. They are so, so heavy. I can't overstate how heavy they are. And Pete worked for many, many years putting tables up, obviously using certain muscles in his body. And then it was decided by the WPBSA that he would get a desk job, you know, shirt and tie and all that kind of stuff. And I think he'd be the first to agree that he was a square peg in a round hole. And very soon afterwards, he came back to doing the table fitting. But one thing that happened when he was doing the desk job and doing other tasks was he found real difficulty with his hands, because he'd been so used to using them all the time. And suddenly his whole body reacted to the fact he wasn't picking these slates up. And it was quite a sort of painful experience for him for a few months before, obviously, then he got back into his old task and he was fine.
Well, the last chat we had like this a few weeks ago about players and such like was, I mentioned the Scottish guy, Jimmy McNellan, who people will remember. He actually was a table fitter for a number of years, and I think you're right, there was almost a fitness thing. If he got laid off it for whatever reason for a month or a couple of months, getting back into it was horrible, because you could lose a finger with those things in like the blink of an eye. Really, really dangerous job. But and touching on, yeah, he went to the kind of office job, didn't he?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's not a good thing for the tables, basically. And then when he went back to do the tables, I thought, that's good for everyone.
That was on the basis that plenty of people could have done the job he was going to, but not a lot of people could do the job he did on the tables, which was excellent.
Yeah, I mean, the point is every venue's different, isn't it? You know, and they're all different challenges. I mean, the Crucible's actually one of the hardest ones because they drop the stage and there's those acroprops under the stage. Some venues have multiple tables, so, you know, it's a lot of work. And, you know, we hear players sometimes complain about things, but players turn up on day one, it's all there already. They don't see all the work that's gone on. And you see them at the end descend when it's all over, and it's hard work, you know, it's through the night. Again, it's not glamorous, but it's very, very important for these tournaments because obviously the playing conditions help the players to play their best snooker. So Pete and all the guys who do that, you know, it's like you say, Neil, it's hard slog.
Hard slog, very much so, yeah. A job I wouldn't want to do, and as I say, I think... I've heard players talking about, there should be more practice tables in the venue. And I just think that's every table fitter's nightmare. That thought there could be a load more tables that have got to be maintained. Anyway, that's what they do.
And Pete was their head honcho when we used to have the 24, 26 table set up at the Norborough Castle Hotel in the early 90s. Now, imagine that, maintaining it. Putting those tables up, 26 tables
at a time. Absolutely. It was a great servant to the sport for a long time.
Definitely, yeah. Neil, we're back with you.
Okay, we did mention this name yesterday, but I think Alan Hughes, the former MC, must be worth a little mention, mustn't he? He's still alive. I spoke to him last week on the phone, actually. I think he was 88 earlier in the week. And what a character, Phil. I mean, what a character. You know, not only... doing his job, but away from the mic. What a great character!
Incredible. I dreamt about him twice this week.
Too much information.
Yeah. Honestly, last night, and so I woke up and I'm like, oh, and then you realise it's sort of all a dream kind of thing. So, but yeah, it just made me realise. You know, I was lying there sort of trying to get back to sleep, thinking about it. What a great guy he was. A professional footballer with Brentford, Norwich, and I think he signed part-time terms with Tottenham as well. He knew Jimmy Greaves. And what he used to do, he was in show business from the age of 16, and he'd go and play a summer season in Great Yarmouth and then come back and play football over the winter. So he was a very skilled footballer. He was very good at table tennis as well, actually. And he knew Willie Thorne's family before Willie ever got into snooker. He actually used to babysit Willie when the great WT was a baby. So he'd been involved. He'd been involved in that kind of sense. And then of course Willie got him involved in the Master of Ceremonies work, and I thought he was just excellent.
I didn't know he would be able to do that. I mean, I knew him, as you say, we knew him already, and I thought, well, hang on, how does this work? But he knew how to do the job.
Well, the thing is, before Alan, that role was very much, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Davis, Cliff Thorpe. He brought a bit of showbiz to it. Now, we have Rob, obviously. Now, Rob Walker's brilliant, and Phil Seymour, Tahi Ajat, they do a great job. But Alan established that as being actually a role. It wasn't just something anyone could do. He established it. And it's very important, because your role is to welcome the people in, to make them feel, before anything starts, you're welcome, this is going to be enjoyable, obviously give them all the house rules, and then give it a bit of something when the players come out.
He had a way of doing it at the Crucible. It was a kind of like a slow dance, like a step that way, then back, and then a step that way, and then the other, so that he can address the whole audience. It was pure class. I loved his suits. He was like old school London-y, I'm guessing it, you know, from somewhere in London. And we call it the patter, obviously, up in Glasgow. His patter was brilliant. And to this day, most times I see John Higgins, well, having a laugh, and we'll say like, hello, my baby boy. That was Alan Hughes. Yeah. That's where that comes from. Yeah. All right, baby. You know, that was, when he seen you, that was the kind of, even like, you see, you go to the loo, you're in the gents. Yes. Hello, my baby boy, and all that. But just a brilliant character. But funny enough, there was a tournament, and John told me this. Alan Hughes won't mind. He liked to have a flutter. Didn't
you can say that again.
So he's having a flutter on the matches, and John was playing, I can't remember, it doesn't really matter, but John was a warm favourite, as he would be. And John's going to the gents after the match or something, and he's in the gents doing whatever. And Hughes's came in, but he doesn't know John's in there, and John's won. But Cusey has clearly bet the other guy, and John's won 5-4 in the pink or something. He's like, oh, that John Higgins, he, He done me tonight. He absolutely done me. I'll never forgive him. You know, all that. And John's like, oh, here we go, you know.
But the thing with him is he had some ways of introducing players. Obviously, John was the Wizard of Wishaw. I think he might have invented that, or he might have got him that nickname. But there's a few things he didn't want. If let's just get this right now. If someone was the very talented, it would mean that he was rubbish. Not very talented at all. That was the only way he could think of to describe.
Solid all round game.
Yeah.
Well, that was the death knell.
If you had a solid all round game, then you were no good. And the very likable. In other words, nobody likes this guy. The very likable. Here he is. Give him a big welcome.
And the other one, and I was a victim of this a number of times at the Crucible. I remember one time going out against Ronnie, 4 behind with a session to go. So I come out overnight, coming out, lamb at the slaughter. You're not going to win. And he's going, with a mountain to climb, the Scottish. Like, that means I've got no chance.
What it really means is, ladies and gentlemen, this will be over in 20 minutes. The curtain will go up and you can watch the closer match on the other table. Right? This rubbish will be over in a minute.
He may as well have just said it. Yeah.
He was a great entertainer. He worked at the Talk of the Town. He worked at the London Palladium. And he also used to open for Lovelace Watkins, who was a very, very big cabaret star in the 70s. He was a former Golden Gloves boxer in America who would become a really popular singer. He performed in Las Vegas as well, Alan, so he was very confident in front of people. He did occasionally, though, make mistakes, and I think the best one ever was at the Assembly Rooms in Derby when he was introducing Alex Higgins. Now, there's always pressure involved when you're introducing Alex Higgins, or you're writing about Alex Higgins, or you're playing him, or you're refereeing, or whatever you're doing around him, there's pressure. So Alan clearly fell victim to the pressure, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce the very, very, and then he said 13 verys, because I can't count them. The very, 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 and on about the 9th very, Alex has gone, the bleep's forgotten my name. And finally, after 30, he remembered who it was. Alex, he came,
Another thing I remember him quite well for the time, when I was my first probably 2, 3, 4 years as a professional, he announced all the big Eubank fights, didn't he?
Yes,
Eubank,
yeah.
Ben,
yeah,
Eubank, Watson, Ben, all those. He was with the white, evening jacket with a red carnation and all. He's just pure class. Yeah.
It was a very good MC, brilliant. But to get their sort of full money's worth out of him, the World Snooker, in the end, they got him to do other duties backstage, including cutting the cuttings out of the newspaper. So there's a snooker story, and he'd have to cut it out and stick it, which is quite demeaning, really, actually, with the MC. But anyway, he was known for basically missing all the cuttings. It could literally have been on the front page, main story, he would miss it. So you would sort of get, you think there's not much in the papers today, and then you'd realise he'd missed half of them. And they also got him to do these backstage tours for school children, which basically involved him bring them backstage. He'd get everyone's name wrong. He'd say, this is so-and-so. It wouldn't be them. And then eventually, it sort of ended when he went into this BBC studio, sort of uninvited, and David Vine was there sort of getting ready for the programme. All these sort of young tearaways trailing behind Alan. And sort of Alan's done the big spiel. This is Mr. Vine, and he's in charge, and you see him on the television, all this sort of thing. Have you got any questions? And this sort of little kid put his hand up. When are we going to make someone famous? So that was the end of that. But no, I mean, he was just a very, very funny man. I'm glad he's doing well.
He's all right. He's okay. He still follows the snooker.
He's missed on the circuit, very much so. And, like I say, he established that role that others obviously have taken on. We're back with you, Alan.
Yeah, I thought long and hard about this last one, actually, and it's between two. But I'm going to go for a guy who I knew briefly. He wasn't a snooker player, but he was friend of, actually, Alan Hughes in the great WT. I only know him as Racing Raymond. And I'm guessing that Phil and Boldy would maybe know a little about him. He was a real character.
Well, he was. I mean, he was a bookmaker, wasn't he? And he was a real character. But, I mean, he was the kind of guy that, he was Willie's best friend, but he'd also back him all the time, wouldn't he? Mm. You know, and when he missed that blue is the story, that the blue in the UK final, and we still say it now, it was an unmissable blue! Because that's what he said, wasn't it, at the time? We still say that now. Because I think Raymond, it probably cost him a load of money. But that was his experience. It wasn't unmissable blue, it was just the way he said it.
I used to write for the commentary evening Telegraph on Mick Price's matches, and Mick was playing really, really well. The reason I know it, because I was obviously having to watch all these matches. Anyway, we went to Dubai, and back in, this was pre-internet, you couldn't get a bet on. And I knew that, you know, Raymond would blow me a price. So I said, well, yeah, what price to make price to win the match? He went, I'll give you 2-1, you know, and well, a couple of quid on it. And I think it might have been a tenner. That I never back big, I'm just too tight. Anyway, Mick won it 2-1, and he came in with the 20 quid. But later on in the day, he came in a full Sheikh's regalia. Yeah, he got the full outfit on, and I don't think that went down.
I don't think
the authorities.
I was thinking about that. I'm not sure it went down. I don't think he meant any harm by it.
No,
it didn't go down too well.
No.
Yeah, I actually remember him in Dubai. That's my abiding memory. Incidentally, what was his name? Raymond.
I did know it. He passed away. I can't think of it now. Yeah. It might come to me. The other thing about him was he was such a huge Willie Thorne fan that I can remember we were watching Willie play. I think it was in UK Championship one time, and he was close match again. He probably had a big belt on him. So now he's got. It was the day before queue extensions, and Willie's got to get all the half putt out and all that, and he said, don't worry, he's the greatest player with the half putt I've ever seen. As if that's a thing.
Oh, you play a shot about every 2 months with a half putt.
One of the best stories about Race and Raymond involved a swear word, and I've got to say the swear word if I tell the story, so I'll go to the arbiter.
I don't know what it is, Phil, but I will allow it. If there's any complaints, then
okay, they're at this meeting in Newmarket it was, and there was this horse called My Baboo, and anyway, Raymond laid this horse, and he lost a fortune because the horse won. So as they're leaving, someone said to him, "Well, Racing, did you do My Baboo?" He went, "No, I did My Babolics."
That's the story, Adam. That's the one with Adam. I'll tell you one other one. I'll tell you another one out in that Dubai trip. Oh, that was brilliant. We went to the aviation club, the little mini golf course and all that, and Folsey would have been there. So there was entertainment on, wasn't it? Like belly dancers and all sorts. It was just a really nice night, great food and all that. He's on the stage with the little band, and he's got the mic, but he's wearing, I don't know what the name for it is, you know what the sheikhs wear over there, the full regalia?
Yes.
With the headdress thing and the whatever, you know, I don't know the name of it, but he had the full thing on.
Yes.
And you're like, this might not be the thing, but you just such a warm guy, wouldn't he?
I don't think we ever went back there, actually, to Dubai. coincidentally or not.
Maybe that was the reality.
Yeah, the snooker authorities weren't too enamoured with him for that.
Well, I'm going to end with one myself, and he was a player, but this is the Snooker Scene podcast, and Snooker Scene recently, there have been some changes. It's Clive Everson, the person I'm going to talk about, because he's retired from journalism after 51 years of editing the magazine every month for 51 years. Nick Metcalf, who people will know from Talking Snooker, has become the new editor, so it's a sort of crossover, which is, you know, exciting for the magazine going forward. But I just thought we would reflect on Clive's extraordinary contribution to snooker. He was championing snooker long before it was on television, long before anyone else really wanted anything to do with it. He, as a young journalist, tried to get it in the newspapers, obviously commentated for decades, and, gave everything to it.
Oh, absolutely. As you say, he was a player, but I don't think he's as well known as that. He's a good billiards player. Strangely enough, he used to represent Wales at snooker billiards. I never really understood that.
Well, he lived there when he was younger.
Yeah, I don't think anyone particularly thinks of him as Welsh, do they?
No.
But, his playing was not such a big achievement as everything else that he ever did. No doubt about it. I mean, I was very lucky to work with, you know, Clive at the start of my sort of time doing the commentary, because you need roles are there for you. Clive knows his role, you know your role. He never ever used to turn the mic off at any point. That was the one thing I will say, and Alan would have worked, and you two guys won't have done, strangely, Phil and Dave, because you're in the same role, but the mic would always be on. But he didn't always say a lot with the mic on, did he? You know, he'd say what needed to be said, and he had a very good way with words. And I think he's still, you know, the best I've, present company, except, you know what I'm saying? No, I think he's the best I've worked with in that. You know, I think he laid down these ground rules from the start, which now we all work with, I think, or most of us do.
Actually, I think he might be kind of responsible for the reason I'm sitting here, because when ITV came back on to do the Champion of Champions in 2013, I got an email or a phone call from production at ITV, and it was about maybe coming on board and doing some pundit and commentary and stuff. That I thought, brilliant. And I could be wrong, but I think the main producer, it would have been Joe Blake Turner at the time, asked Clive, because he was on board as lead commentator, is there anyone, you know, in the circuit that maybe you could suggest to maybe come on and have a go at doing whatever? And I think Clive put my name forward a little, and so that's probably the reason why I'm sitting here, you know, apart from the obvious, an amazing commentator. I'm grateful to him personally for that. But some of the great lines, isn't it? It's the lines of finishing matches or frames or big tournaments. The one with Ronnie O'Sullivan, when he made his 1,000th century, and you know, he gave that. He basically just said, "What a player," didn't he? And it just kind of said everything about the end of the 1,000th century, and just fantastic.
Snooker from the gods, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
In the modern world, if you say that someone's obsessed, it has negative connotations. Not with Clive, he was obsessed with snooker, still is, and he puts so much into it, his commentary, his journalism, his work for Snooker Scene magazine. It was a 24/7 endeavour with him. With me, basically, I was going to say exactly the same thing. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be sitting here. I had an interview with him in September 1988. We'd got some mutual friends, two people called Les Adams and Stan Bates, who were Midland amateur champions, who suggested to Clive that I might be a good candidate to go into the business. And I started off writing local league reports for him, you know, on the Isle Zone League and the Stourbridge League, the Dudley League and all that. And then it progressed from there very, very quickly, actually. Within 3 years, I was doing commentary. But without Clive's blessing and with his guidance, I would not be sitting here now.
Yeah, I mean, he's speaking about those little expressions that he would use. I can think of one from the other end of the scale, and you're not going to say the shootout. The first ever shootout, Clive was doing that. And I don't know about you, but I think that when we do the snooker shootout, we generally speak more for those 10 minutes, because it feels as if you, long periods of silence wouldn't be the right thing, whereas it might be the rest of the time. Anyway, I can remember the match. It was Tony Drago, Rory McLeod, and it went down to the last black with seconds to spare. I think Drago might have been 3 or 4 points in front. Rory McLeod's gone for black. It's gone all round the table. He's got a double kiss. It's gone into the pocket with a second to go. And I thought, what's Clive going to say here? He's not going to say great snooker. He said. So he looked. He couldn't. He wound himself up. And he went incredible. His whole head like went up to the ceiling. He had to get it out, and it was probably the right thing to say. But I did not expect to see it, and I was the only one there to witness it. The way he screamed out the top of his voice.
Well, you know, he's very well known for falling off his chair, isn't he, at Preston Guildhall when he was commentating with Dennis Taylor, reaching over instinctively, grabbing Dennis's tie like a, you know, you would ring a bell, I suppose, and nearly throttling.
Trying to take him down with him.
Yeah, exactly. Clive went out the back of the door, and it was all very, very funny. But if you think about it, why did he do that, right? The reason he did it was because he was such a perfectionist, and he'd said that someone needed one snooker and they needed two, and then he made another mistake. And he was so, you know, oh, what have I done kind of thing. And by the way, this was in the frame that wasn't going to be shown, because once he got to snookers needed, they weren't going to show the frame anyway. Yeah. And he was so aghast that he'd made this mistake. That's why he fell off his chair. He was that kind of person. He was absolutely a perfectionist.
Yeah, definitely was it. I honestly feel kind of privileged to, you know, because you hear him all through your childhood, growing up, and then early times of pro. So to get to work with him, and when the first couple of years at the Champion of Champions in Coventry, I would go up, you'd maybe be in vision in the studio, so you'd get suited and booted and go up at on air 12:45. You'd maybe go up at 11, half 11, especially early in the week, and he'd be sitting with a, you know, notepad there, and he'd just be sitting like kind of staring into space the odd time, and the odd time he'd just jot something down. And like I used to sit at the top of the match if I was lucky enough to be in the comm box with him, and I used to guess. I think, I wonder what he's going to say, you know, when he gets called over to you comms in his opening gambit, his opening line. I used to think, what would I say? And it would, you would never, of course, get the line that he would come out with. He was brilliant.
I'm now not the most punctual into the comms box, but I'm not as bad as some. But I don't think I ever got into the commentary box to work with him before him. He would always be in there. And there would be a time, at the Crucible, where I think one day I got in there half an hour early. I thought, I'm going to have a bit of lunch in there or something, just wait for the match to start. And he was already in there. I'd never got to the box before him. You know, he was always in there mentally preparing. And sometimes in the days now when you've got a 15-minute gap, more recent ICV events, you know, you could hardly get out of the commentary box, and he was almost knocking you over trying to get in there.
Well, it was vital to the ITV tournaments that we were lucky enough to work on. I think a year or two before he sort of retired, they would get a taxi, wouldn't they? You know, they wanted him on the production, in the box, because he's that good. And, he wasn't getting around as nimbly as what he would in his youth. But they would get a taxi to the venue for him every day and make sure that he was there when he even had a little trouble getting around.
And I think it's important to get this impression over of him. I know him obviously very, very, very well, as we all do. He's very anti-establishment. He's very irreverent. He's very funny as well also. He's one of these people who's liberal in life. And maybe that doesn't come across sometimes in his commentary, but he's a really good guy, and he's been very, very kind to me, and I know Dave would endorse that.
I think a lot of his... He was a massive tennis fan, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He played tennis.
Played in Wimbledon.
Speaking of which, he attempted to write a novel. I was telling this story the other day. He attempted to write a novel about... It's actually about the tennis circuit, but you can imagine it's kind of really the snooker circuit, just sort of changed. But this was years ago. This was old... I mean, Clive's old school anyway. So he wrote it out by hand in the office, you know, a sort of page a day. And then the idea was, when he was virtually finished, 90% finished, he's going to take it all home, go through it, revise it. So he's come out of the office, put all the handwritten papers on the top of his car. And this was in the days when you had to literally use a key to open your car. So he's put them on the top of the car, gone to open the door, and of course what's happened? Massive gust of wind, all gone. All just gone. To this day, in Kidderminster, there's still the odd page of this sort of literary masterpiece, lost forever. One thing, just in closing, I would say is, we all got a lot to thank Clive for. Snooker certainly has a lot to thank Clive for. This is the Snooker Scene podcast. It wouldn't exist without him. Having said that, Clive has never listened to a podcast in his life, and that's another reason to admire him, I think. Obviously, you know, we still speak to me and Phil, and he's still following the snooker. So thank everybody, and we'll do it again sometime.
So that's it. Thanks to Neil, Phil and Alan, and there'll be more of that, I'm sure, in the future. Next week we'll deal with emails, and we'll be, of course, into the thick of the UK Championship. As I say, in York this year, promises to... hopefully be restored to something like former glories and the status of the tournament back to where it should be. In the meantime, we are proud members of the Sports Social Network. Check out their other podcasts. You can email us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. But for now, as we always say, goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.